Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Before Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered the invasion of Ukraine last year, many of the world's largest economies had already prepared a raft of sanctions against Russia. Here's President Joe Biden on February 24th, 2022, the day of the invasion.
For months, we've been building a coalition of partners representing well more than half the global economy. 27 members of the European Union, including France, Germany, Italy, as well as the United Kingdom, Canada, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and many others, to amplify the joint impact of our response.
Those nations had hoped the threat of sanctions would be adequate persuasion to prevent Russia's invasion. But of course, that did not work. As noted, Biden gave this speech as Russian forces were entering Ukraine. So the president announced even harsher sanctions.
Today, I'm authorizing additional strong sanctions and new limitations on what can be exported to Russia. This is going to impose severe costs on the Russian economy, both immediately and over time.
Biden claimed that even though new sanctions were needed, the ones already in place were damaging Russia's economy.
We've already seen the impact of our actions on Russia's currency and the ruble, which early today hit its weakest level ever in history. The Russia stock market plunged today.
Biden also said something else, that the sanctions weren't just a punitive action against the current invasion of Ukraine. They were designed to hinder Russian ambition in the long term.
We estimate that we'll cut off more than half of Russia's high-tech imports. It'll strike a blow to their ability to continue to modernize their military. It'll degrade their aerospace industry, including their space program. It'll hurt their ability to build ships, reducing their ability to compete economically. And it will be a major hit to Putin's long-term strategic ambitions.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 1 year has passed. The Russian military is still in Ukraine. And the war is overshadowing all discussions at the G20 in India this week. And last week, the U.S. and Europe announced a 10th round of new sanctions, bringing the total to more than 11,800 international sanctions against Russia, according to the Atlantic Council. So given the initial goal of the sanctions, as stated by President Biden last year, have they worked? And how do we ever measure sanctions effectiveness? Well, Adam Smith joins us today. He's former senior advisor at the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, which enforces sanctions. He's also former director for multilateral affairs at the National Security Council, and he now runs the sanctions practice for the law firm Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. Adam Smith, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna.
Also with us today is Frank Vogel. He's co-founder of the anti-corruption non-governmental organization Transparency International and a professor of government at Georgetown University and author of The Enablers, How the West Supports Kleptocrats and Corruption Endangering Our Democracy. Professor Vogel, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Meghna.
I'd like to start actually by seeing if we all share a common definition for what the 10 rounds of sanctions that we've seen in the past year were designed to achieve. So, Adam Smith, let me start with you. How would you define what the international community's goals for the sanctions were and are?
Well, I think they've changed, to be honest. I do think that to start with, President Biden and the alliance were really trying to have the sanctions be a deterrent. When that proved to be unsuccessful, I think they did pivot, and they pivoted to a couple of ideas that I think continue to this day. The first, I think, is to degrade Russia's ability to continue fighting the war on the terms it would like, limiting the ability to digitize its military, recoup its losses, etc. So that's sort of a actual economic and physical goods sort of restrictions into Russia. And then perhaps even more importantly is a messaging one. right? When parties are sanctioned, especially by such a global, multilateral approach, there is a message that, what they are doing is outside the norm and really beyond the pale. So I think a combination of actual degradation of abilities combined with a messaging that what they're doing is completely inappropriate.
Okay, so Frank Vogel, same question to you.
Well, first of all, I totally agree with what Adam is saying. Deterrence before the invasion started was clearly a very important factor. But it was also important as a mechanism to build the coalition that President Biden was so interested in doing. And many countries might not have been able to agree at that time on military cooperation and so forth, but agreeing on economic sanctions in the event of a Russian invasion was a very useful mechanism to get that sort of coalition building going. The second point I would make is that the sanctions come in two fundamental different forms. One is sanctions on the Russian economy and on the Russian state. Mm-hmm. And the second type of sanctions are sanctions on individuals. Mm-hmm. All the members of the Russian parliament, the Duma, have been sanctioned. Many businessmen have been sanctioned. Many people in the Kremlin individually have been sanctioned. And the purpose there is to place increasing pressure on the Kremlin to force an end to the aggression by making life really tough for all the individuals sanctioned. The hope is that they in turn will influence President Putin to relent and change policy.
Okay, so let's take this then kind of in tranches, if I can put it that way. We're in agreement that the initial round of sanctions, or the initial intent, was deterrence. You know, with the qualification, Professor Vogel, that you put in about coalition building, and both of you said that the deterrence goal was not met. Obviously, the war still continues. So my question to both of you, and again, Adam Smith, I'll start with you: Have sanctions ever worked as a method of deterrence when the international community disapproves of an action that a nation is taking?
It's a great question and a very fair one, but it forces us to sort of ponder counter-historicals. So when I was still in the government and working on the first round of Russia sanctions after the Crimea invasion in 2014, there were Ukrainians, and there were sanctions then not nearly as comprehensive as they are today. There were Ukrainians at the time after 2014 who sort of said, well, the sanctions aren't working because Russia is still in Crimea, which is where they were at the time. However, there were other Ukrainians who would tell me that, in fact, the sanctions did work because if not for them, Russia would have already been in Kyiv or Lviv or elsewhere, right? So it forces this sort of interesting counter-historical. I mean, there are cases, I would argue, if not of deterrence, of certainly compulsion, where sanctions, for example, brought Iran to the table for the nuclear talks, early, maybe five to ten years ago at this stage. There are cases with the apartheid, cases with Libya, cases with the former Yugoslavia, where sanctions have changed the calculus of those in charge in a way that supported the policy interests for which the sanctions were imposed. But deterrence is a very challenging sort of assessment because you're always trying to prove that which did not happen or that which happened but might have happened differently.
Okay. Well, so that which did not happen, in my mind, is also, in a sense, an answer to the deterrent question because it did not happen, right? And so Professor Vogel, what I wonder then is why do... When speaking about the first round of sanctions last year, why was the idea of deterrence even publicly mentioned? Realistically, very few people in the international community, very few leaders thought that it would deter Russia from invading Ukraine.
I think we have to put ourselves back 1 year. What Russia did was almost unthinkable, unspeakable, possibly starting a new Cold War. The issue was that of freedom. So when then Prime Minister Boris Johnson got up in the House of Commons on that day, after having spoken to President Zelensky early in the morning, Johnson, with Churchillian vigor, he loves Churchill, said, and I'm going to quote him here. He said, "We will continue on a remorseless mission to squeeze Russia from the global economy piece by piece, day by day, and week by week." And then a few weeks later, because you quoted earlier in the program President Biden, mm-hmm. the White House issued a fact sheet in late March, and it quoted the International Institute of Finance as saying that the Russian economy in 2022 would be crippled by 15%. Now, the question that you could ask academics would be, well, was that realistic? Was Boris Johnson just hyping it up and it was just nice rhetoric? Well, the Russian economy didn't fall by 15%. The Russian economy fell by a total of 2.2%, according to the International Monetary Fund. And when President Biden, in your quote earlier in the program, announced that the ruble had fallen to its lowest level in history, yes, he was right on that day. But today, the ruble is at exactly the same level as it was before the war started. And in fact, for most of 2022, it went significantly higher. Mm. So the whole point I'm trying to make is, if you're going to say sanctions are to be a deterrent, and you're going to come out with all this robust rhetoric, you better make sure that happens. Mm. And we have failed, and the failure encourages Vladimir Putin as people are being killed today in Ukraine.
So this is really the crux of today's conversation. And Adam Smith, we have 1 minute to go before our first break. I'm going to give you also another shot after we take the break. But your first response to Professor Vogel, when he basically is insisting that the sanctions have been overall ineffective at hampering or crippling Russia's military ambitions or Russia's economy?
Well, I do disagree. Certainly on the military ambition side, it's very clear that they are not fighting the war they want to fight. And that's partly because of problems in command and control, but also problems with the ability of, again, recouping losses. Having to go to second and third tier suppliers like the Iranians to go after to get their own drones doesn't seem to be the way the Russians in a 21st century sort of warfare want to be fighting. So I do think it has been impacting them and the success of the Ukrainians as well. On the economic side, we could talk about after the break, but I do think there's a lot of evidence that has really harmed Russia's economy on a macro perspective and on a micro perspective today and, frankly, well into the future.
Okay, so that's what we'll do when we come back. We're talking today with Adam Smith and Frank Vogel, and we're trying to really parse out what the impact of sanctions have been on Russia and whether they've met any of the several goals that the international community said the sanctions were intended to do. So we'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just last week, the U.S. and European Union announced a 10th round of sanctions against Russia. So today we're asking, what did the previous 9 rounds achieve? And we're joined today by Frank Vogel. He's co-founder of Transparency International and a professor of government at Georgetown University. And Adam Smith is with us well. He currently runs the sanctions practice for the law firm Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher and was a former senior advisor at the Treasury Department in the Office of Foreign Assets Control. So, Adam Smith, pick up where we left off. I'd love to hear sort of your analysis of where the Russian economy stands now and how, you know, how we use that to measure the effectiveness of sanctions so far.
Absolutely. So as I said, there are significant sort of characteristics of the Russian economy that are true today that certainly weren't true prior to the sanctions that I think are caused by the sanctions, directly and indirectly. I mean, the big one, of course, is that it's completely scrambled the deck as to where Russia gets its money from with respect to its oil and gas sales. You know, it used to be very, very linked up with Europe, of course, and now it's increasingly delinked from Europe. And I think it does change sort of the uncertainties with respect to Russia on a going forward basis. Second of all, you've seen in the actual manufacturing and sort of real economy space, you know, the closure of factories, the inability for Russia to continue importing high-end computer chips and other sorts of technology that makes it very challenging for Russia to continue competing in a global economy. Its entire civil aviation sector has been essentially shuttered because of the restrictions with respect to European and U.S. measures as well. And perhaps most importantly, the one that is really unseen in some ways, is the incredible brain drain that you've seen in Russia. Tens of thousands of Russians, high-educated Russians, who could leave, have left and gone to places like the UAE and in Europe and, of course, in the U.S. and elsewhere to get away. And I think that's going to be a huge drain on Russia today, but certainly in the future as well.
Okay, so Professor Vogel, let me just add some data to what Adam Smith said to give it a little bit more shape, because I'm looking at an analysis from the Atlantic Council here. And regarding those Russian energy exports, indeed, before the invasion last year, so I'm looking at some numbers from 2021, the Atlantic Council says, you know, that basically Russian energy exports included the Netherlands, South Korea, U.S., China, Italy, France, Lithuania. I mean, it's like the pie is very colorful with different nations buying Russian exports. Now, China and India alone account for 57% of Russian energy exports. So Russia has become incredibly dependent on just two nations for energy income, which is a radical reduction in diversification here. So that's one way of trying to understand some impacts. And then in addition, I'm seeing here that right now the Russian budget, to add another data point here, is 4 trillion rubles in a deficit. So certainly those are destabilizing impacts, are they not?
Yes, there's no question that the sanctions have had an effect. But overall, look at the fact that we're talking about just a 2% GDP decline last year. The International Monetary Fund sees no decline in the economy this year and actually an upswing towards the end of the year and into next year. So what is really happening? Yes, we can find all sorts of data points from a huge reduction in car production in Russia all the way through to microchip production and so on. But the Turks, the Indians, the Chinese, the United Arab Emirates, and numerous other countries are helping the Russians to beat the sanctions. Yes, our allies, Turkey and the UAE, are right up there in front, helping the Russians to beat the sanctions. There was a lovely little item in the New York Times the other day about how wealthy Russians in Moscow are going to their restaurants. The restaurants are packed, and they can eat sea bass that has been flown in overnight every day from Turkey. I mean, the sanctions are not doing the two things we talked about at the beginning of the program. They are not deterring the Russian will to fight, and they are not, through the individual sanctions, having the effect of adding pressure on Putin to change his policies. And we have to keep our mind, I think, our focus on the fact that our diplomacy relative to sanctions and our justice system relative to sanctions so far have not met the expectations that Biden and Johnson and others set when they made these big announcements 1 year ago.
Yeah, Professor Vogel, I absolutely take your point that, you know, we can pick any subset of data, right, and come up with a conclusion regarding what the impact of the sanctions are. So that does take us back to the fundamental question of what were or are the sanctions purposes. And so, Adam Smith, there's something that you had mentioned earlier that I want to dig into a little bit more. If not deterrence, then at least using sanctions as a lever to get Russia to withdraw from Ukraine, right, is part of what still the ongoing goals are. And I wonder, again, I'm looking at this analysis from the Atlantic Council, and they say that 77% of all sanctions target individuals, and around 22% of them target entities. That's a really interesting delineation here, because you know, we're talking about oligarchs who are very, very, very well funded, right? I mean, they are billionaires. And if the vast majority of sanctions are targeting them, and as Professor Vogel's saying, it's not that hard for them to evade it, or they can suffer a lot of economic pain before they feel motivated to change, why structure the sanctions this way?
Well, it's a good question. And of course, you know, I wasn't in the room this round of sanctions. I was, you know, back in 2014. And there's a couple of issues here. I mean, first of all, individuals are not organizations. And so there are just significantly more of them than there are entities. And so it's not that strange in any sanctions program, be it Iran or elsewhere, that a lot of individuals are sanctioned and comparatively fewer entities are. But to say that we haven't focused on important entities, I think, is somewhat of a misnomer as well, given that the largest banks, for example, in Russia are now all sanctioned. The energy companies, if not fully sanctioned, are restricted in many ways as well. So there are some – it's a little bit of apples and oranges in some respects. Secondly, when you talk about the purpose of the sanctions and what's actually being achieved, again, the battlefield issues I think are very important to remember. It is true that the Russian battle into Ukraine has been shambolic perhaps to start from the start, and certainly people in the military can speak to this more intelligently than I can. But when it comes to going after getting replenishment of stocks, be it ammunition, be it tanks or otherwise, their inability. I mean, and Putin, you might remember, the past 10 years has been devoted to digitizing and modernizing the military, it's been a massive failure. And so these sanctions are making it difficult for Russia to wage the war. And so if that's the only impact, and it really isn't in my mind, if that's the only impact, I actually think it's still worthwhile, these measures, because it makes it more difficult for Russia to fight the war, and it gives Ukraine a much more effective fighting chance.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation here, because Professor Vogel, you had mentioned earlier about how Russia is, they're getting help evading sanctions. And in fact, the Russian nation seems to be pretty good at figuring out some ways around this huge number of sanctions against the country. So let me now bring into the conversation Sergei Alexashenko. Sergei is former Russian deputy finance minister and first deputy chairman of the Russian Central Bank. Currently, Sergei is an independent consultant and a member of the Stanford University's International Working Group on Russian Sanctions. Sergei Alexashenko, welcome to you.
Magda, hello. Nice to be with you today.
Okay, so first of all, I'd like to get your sense of the trajectory of the impact of sanctions. In the first part of 2022, what impact do you think the sanctions regimes had on Russia?
I would say that sanctions definitely hurt significantly Russian economy. And in the beginning of 2022, the official forecast for the Russian economy was growth above 4%. And the official statistical data for the end of the year is minus 2.1, but it was boosted by extra military expenditures at least by 1 percentage point of GDP. So if you look on the international history after 1990, there are very few cases when economy just moved immediately with very good external environment in terms of trade from growth to recession. So that is definitely a very important effect on Russia, but we should not overestimate the potential of sanctions. Russia is one of the major suppliers of raw materials, of commodities to the global market. For example, its share in international trade in oil is 17% in oil and refined products. And you cannot just remove Russian oil from the market. Because after that, the oil crisis of 1973 will be peanuts. Yeah, it will be much more severe for the global economy. So the idea of oil sanctions is to reduce revenues for the Russian budget, to reduce revenues for the Russian economy. And my estimate says that the Russian budget did not receive at least $65 billion last year because of reduced oil prices. So sanctions do work, but they cannot lead to political changes. Otherwise, we should have completely different political regimes in North Korea, in Venezuela, in Iraq, in Iran, and so on. So let's be realist. Politicians may declare goals or slogans that are very colorful, but they're very far from reality.
Yeah. So the presumption in sanctions leading or assisting, let's say, the growth of enough discontent in a country that it would lead to political change requires that people are feeling enough discontent. So how can we understand if, you know, are the Russian middle classes suffering at all from a year of international sanctions?
Magna, it's a nice question, but being honest, we have to say that majority of sanctions targeting households' consumption, individual consumption, were oriented or were pushing on people with incomes above average or high incomes. Yeah, and for example, lack of new cars, lack of ability to travel to Europe. Lack of ability to transfer funds abroad, lack just inability to fund your families, your kids who are learning in the UK or US universities. That's a problem for the high incomes. It's not a problem for ordinary Russians. And the polls in Russia says that it's more than 60% of Russians, they do not feel the pressure of sanctions at all. And if you ask them, what is the impact of sanctions on your ordinary life? They say, okay, it's price, it's inflation. But inflation is the major concern for Russians since 1990. So it's, yes, the problem is that sanctions that were imposed, they do not target the living standards of ordinary people.
I can't tell if that was Frank or Adam smiling along with me, because I think we all had the same reaction, Sergey, when you said inflation has been a primary concern in Russia since 1990. But I want to lean on your expertise here as former deputy chairman of the Russian Central Bank. Can you just briefly describe to me what you saw the central bank do in response to sanctions both last year and then in the first part of this year to cope with the ones that were particularly targeted towards Russia's ability to operate in the global financial system?
Mm-hmm. It's a terrific question. When a year ago, maybe a little bit before Russian invasion, the option to freeze assets of the Russian Central Bank was called as nuclear option, because everybody believed it will be a devastating effect for the Russian economy. And in fact, it happened. Inflation in Russia jumped up to 10% per month just in 2 weeks. In the beginning of March, the inflation was exceeding 10% per month. That is great. And ruble lost 60% of its value. But let's not underestimate the technical capabilities of the staff in the Russian Central Bank. They're sophisticated and clever enough. And the decision they found, it was very innovative. They first made the Russian ruble not fully convertible. So they banned or restricted many of capital transactions and even current transactions. So the demand for foreign exchange was reduced drastically. And that led to the very strong current account in the balance of payment of Russia. And as economists, any economist may tell you that if the country has a very strong current account, in fact, currency reserves of the central bank, they do not play a very significant role. You may live without them. Mm. Nevertheless, the economy adjusted. Usually, any economy adjusts very fast to financial sanctions. And as we see, ruble strengthened up by something like 40%, 50% by middle of 2022. But at the year end, once again, is devalued. And nowadays, it is on the same level as a year ago. So this effect is over. And but still, Russian ruble is non-convertible. And Russian arrears in paying dividends, in paying coupons, in paying royalties, in paying capital gains, they're accumulating from day to day. So sooner or later, Russian economy will pay this price.
Yeah. So I was just going to ask, and Frank and Adam, I promise I'm going to get back to you here, but it seems like doing things like making currencies semi-convertible only or restricting dividend payments, that can't last long, can it, Sergey?
Oh, no, it can last long because in the Soviet Union, ruble was non-convertible from the beginning, from the end of the 1920s until 1990. So it could be for 60 years or even more.
Well, let me rephrase that. It can't last long without an accumulation of consequences, is what you were saying.
Yes, of course. Yes, of course. And that is the price. Okay, any action of it has its consequences. And of course, the short-term gains of the Russian Central Bank, they will provide the big losses tomorrow. So it's like kicking the can down the road, but this can will transform into a bucket and then into the barrel.
Okay, so we only have you for one more minute, Sergei. Let me just ask you, do you see a strategic value in the sanctions regime, or how do you think it ought to be adjusted if the international community continues to have interest in getting Russia out of Ukraine?
Magna, I do not see any sanctions that may change political calculus of Vladimir Putin, because for him it's not a war where he measures costs and benefits, weighs his resources. It's existential war, and I do not believe that any sanctions will stop him running the war. Moreover, yes, maybe Russian industry capacities to produce sophisticated weapons will be limited because of the Western sanctions, but Russia has a huge stock of old weapons that can be used and are used in Ukraine. So unfortunately, sanctions do not stop the war.
Well, Sergei Alexashenko, former Russian deputy finance minister and first deputy chairman of the Russian Central Bank, currently a consultant and member of Stanford University's International Working Group on Russian Sanctions. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Magna.
Frank Vogel and Adam Smith, when we come back from the other side of this brief break, I'm going to want to get your responses to what you heard Sergei share with us just now. So hang in there. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I really want to give you a heads up on something we're working on for next week, because I want to know what you think about it. We are going to be doing a show about the pros and cons of a four-day work week. So I want to know if you, by choice, or if your company has allowed you to do such a thing, have you worked a four-day work week regularly? What was it like? Was it good? Was it bad? What impact did it have on your company? Is it an option you would like to have? If you are a business owner or a manager, are there pros that you can see to a four-day work week, or are there cons to it? What are the potential drawbacks of people working four and not your typical five-day, 40-hour work week? So share your experience and thoughts on our On Point Vox Pop app. You can get it at your app store. Just look for On Point Vox Pop. Or you can also call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about whether or not the international community's year of sanctions against Russia have been effective. And I'm joined by Frank Vogel and Adam Smith. And Adam, let me get your responses to some of the things that Sergei was telling us. It sounds like one conclusion we can draw from what he said is that because, you know, the Russian Central Bank has found at least temporary ways to soften the impact of sanctions, and that most middle-class Russians aren't even really feeling it, that the sanctions weren't strong or hard enough to provide the kinds of changes that the international community was hoping for. What do you think?
I mean, that's a fair sort of criticism, and certainly a fair point. And Sergey made a couple of points that I think are interesting to sort of focus in on. One, I think it's important to remember that the Russian economy is twice, perhaps depending on your count, twice the combined size of every economy the U.S. had ever sanctioned prior to Russia. It's a much, much bigger player than any other economy, be it Iran, be it Burma, be it Venezuela or otherwise. And with that size is not only incredible interdependencies that allow you to sort of, because there was a diversified base perhaps of sales of oil and oil and gas, et cetera. But on top of that, you had an incredibly sophisticated, still do, bureaucratic class that has been very successful, I would argue, in sort of mitigating some of the initial harms. But the piper will need to be paid at some point. And this goes back to the question of whether the sanctions in question are a marathon versus a sprint. Over time, whatever Putin wants to do, he's going to be hemmed in from doing because of the economy, which will increasingly sort of be if not constricted entirely, certainly reduced with respect to its potential output. Okay. So I think Sergey is 100% right that there's immediate sort of impact that's been perhaps lessened, but perhaps over time, maybe in the near term, that will become increased.
So we'll come back to that in just a moment. But Frank Vogel, Sergey also made the other point that we had been, you know, we touched on earlier, that because of what Russia is, it being a major source of not just energy, but, you know, even things like precious metals, nickel, palladium, things that like countries around the world need, that perhaps the international community finds itself in a catch-22, that it may have wanted to come down hard on Russia, but for our own self-preservation, it could not.
Yes, I think that's partly right. And that's why you're seeing sanction busting as well from the Turks and from the UAE and others. But I think we need to step back, if I may, just a little bit. Mm. Russia is not a normal economy. This is a country run by a kleptocratic regime that steals massively from its people. There is a huge informal economy that doesn't go through the data and the statistics. There is a very large group of people, many of whom have now individually been sanctioned, who run the economy within the economy. They have assets all over the world. They are protected by some of the world's biggest banks and by some of the most reputable law firms in the world who have no shame and work for these oligarchs and their assets. Just yesterday, the Swiss, under enormous pressure from various governments, said they would take action against some of the dirty money in Switzerland from Russia. So what did they do? They prosecuted four people at Gazprom Bank, that is the Swiss affiliate of Russia's Gazprom energy company. And they went after, they said, people who had been aiding a cellist. Now, if you like music, maybe you've heard of Sergei Roldugin, but he has $50 million, apparently, according to the Swiss authorities, in a Swiss bank. He is a front man for Vladimir Putin. We need to understand that when we look at sanctions and the Russian economy, we have to directly address this unbelievably huge and efficient and effective corruption conspiracy that keeps Putin in power, that keeps his wealth, that allows so many people in the top of the Russian intelligence service, the military, the bureaucracy, and of course the business community to live a very good life, even though we've announced sanctions on them. And so long as they have all this comfort and maybe a little bit of inconvenience because of sanctions, then we're not getting a real sense of really having effective sanctions. Mm. So we need to really boost our Justice Department, stop it from putting out silly little statements about how they're doing more than ever before. Let them bring these people to justice. Let them name the names. Let them seize and then confiscate the assets. And let's put real pressure on these people. And if we don't, then I'm afraid history will say the sanctions were more bluster and fine rhetoric than real hardship for Russia.
So here's what this brings to mind. Bringing real pressure means bringing real pressure on certain aspects of the global financial system. gets a little complicated here. So I wonder if you could both just listen along with me, because we spoke recently with Edward Fishman, who once worked on Russia and Iran sanctions at the State Department. Today, he's a professor at Columbia University's Center for Global Energy Policy.
Historically, sanctions have a mixed track record at achieving U.S. foreign policy objectives. And I don't think that's unusual, right? I mean, does military force work? It worked in World War II. It didn't work so well in the Vietnam War, right? So like any tool of statecraft, sanctions have capacity to advance U.S. foreign policy objectives, but they also have capacity to do nothing, and they have the capacity to actually work at cross purposes with what the U.S. is trying to achieve.
Fishman says the blunt force sanctions used many decades ago against Cuba and North Korea are now known as dumb sanctions. Enter the era of smart sanctions.
What really changed after 9/11 and almost happened by accident is that the U.S. stumbled into a whole new set of sanctions tools, all of which were really undergirded by the breadth and significance of the U.S. financial system. And what the Treasury Department recognized really in the mid-2000s was that because really all global commerce in many ways touches the U.S. financial system, either directly or indirectly, the U.S. government has the ability to regulate commerce, to regulate trade flows, even that don't touch the United States at all.
So what led to the creation of smart sanctions? In a word, Iran, and the UN Security Council, German and EU negotiations with Iran to stop its nuclear weapons program approximately 15 years ago.
At the same time, the United States was fighting two wars, one in Afghanistan, another in Iraq, neither of which was going smoothly or according to plan. And so the idea of starting a third war to try to check Iran's nuclear weapons program was unthinkable. And so it really required creative thinking, and the Treasury Department started creating new financial weapons against Iran. And what happened really between 2006 and 2008, so the last 2 years of the Bush administration, is that Iran was ejected from the global financial system. All major banks, whether based in the United States or Europe or Asia, really stopped doing business with Iranian financial institutions. And so Iran became something of a financial pariah.
Okay, so we're going to hear a little bit more from Fishman in a second. But Adam Smith, you know a little something about Iran sanctions. So I just wanted to get your response to what Fishman is saying there, that perhaps we do have a model from recent history.
We definitely do. Professor Fishman is right. We were colleagues together in the U.S. government. And he's right. The Iran model is the model that is sort of called upon as sort of this some combination of both dumb sanctions going after broad jurisdiction as well as smart sanctions going after particular nodes of activity that can take advantage of the U.S.'s unique role as sort of the guarantor, if not the facilitator, of almost all international commerce. Hmm. So that is the strategy that sort of undergirds the Russia strategy. The challenge is that the Russian economy and the bureaucrats in it are just significantly different, much larger, more sophisticated in many respects than the Iran target was. And so that's the challenge. It's sort of balancing tools which we think could work against an economy they've never really been implied against.
Mm. Well, Frank Vogel, I'm going to get to you in a second, but I want to just add another thing that Professor Fishman, Edward Fishman, told us, because he talked about how even with this concept of smart sanctions, there are ways to get around it. And he told us that third parties, and this is really what I wanted to focus on, banks, oil companies, shippers from other countries, in the Iran case, helped Iran buy and sell on the world market.
So banks like Standard Chartered, which is based in the UK, or HSBC, or BNP Paribas, that really had treated violating sanctions as almost a cost of doing business, came under U.S. investigation and scrutiny for violating Iran sanctions and other U.S. sanctions regimes. And these investigations led to massive settlements for sanctions violations with these banks. The BNP Paribas settlement, for instance, was $9 billion, which, in 2014 wiped out its entire profit for the year.
Okay, so Frank Vogel, it's fascinating to me because, you know, regarding shippers, this is happening right now. I mean, the EU allows its shipping companies, insurers, and banks to continue facilitating Russian exports, you know, as long as oil is sold beneath some value that the G7 has set.
And it's not just oil. I mean, banks that maybe people here in this country do not know about are enormous in Russia. The Raiffeisen Bank of Austria had record profits last year in Russia. In fact, 60% of its business now is in Russia because other banks have left. UniCredit, the biggest bank in Italy, had record fourth quarter profits in Russia. These banks continue to operate. They find all manner of legal loopholes because their enablers, these are the law firms again, are able to find little ways in which they can do legitimate business because there are loopholes in the sanctions or loopholes in other laws or regulations. And they're in there making a lot of money and, of course, fundamentally undermining the objective of the sanctions. We have 10 Western oil companies, Western-based oil companies that are legitimately trading in Russian oil and shipping Russian oil. And Global Witness, which is a wonderful investigative organization, has just issued a report showing just how much business they have been doing. So what you have in fundamentally is a sieve. The sanctions are a sieve full of loopholes. And there are lots of lawyers and lots of bankers who know exactly where those loopholes are. And so the Russians are getting away with it. And well, that means we really have to toughen up enforcement.
Well, exactly. So I keep thinking about what Professor Fishman said about banks looking at violating sanctions as almost a cost of doing business. Now, they are only required to pay that cost if the Justice Department and its, you know, its sister departments around the world decide to manage enforcement better. Now this leads us to a final question, which Edward Fishman asks, because he told us that he worries that today's Russia sanctions are morphing into a longer term strategic tool that he wonders could be the dress rehearsal for a new kind of Cold War.
The big question, I think, for the United States in the next 5 to 10 years is, can the U.S. continue to build a robust and thriving form of globalization that exists amongst its democratic allies? So maybe Russia won't be part of that. I think almost certainly Russia won't be part of it. China won't be a full part of it. And in some ways, this goes back to what the global economy looked like during the Cold War, right? The question is, can we keep our allies on side?
Adam Smith, how would you answer that question?
I think it's going to be very challenging. And one of the reasons is actually, it goes back to the BNP Paribas situation that Professor Fishman mentioned. That scared and continues to scare businesses to such a degree that what they're doing when it comes to Russia, for example, is in many respects over-complying. So if you look at the list of companies that the Yale School of Management maintains of companies that have stopped operating in Russia or somehow changed their footprint in Russia, it's well over 1,000 at this point. And what's interesting about that is exactly zero of them were compelled to change that footprint by law. They all did so because of some broader concern about reputation, moral concerns, profit concerns, or otherwise, but non-regulatory. And that suggests that businesses, who after all are the implementing arms of sanctions, right? You've got to remember sanctions are issued by governments but implemented by the private sector, they've already sort of voted with their feet. And so are they moving into a world where this separation, this Cold War, the pressure fish talks about is already their reality because they're so nervous about either a footfault that could get them into trouble with regulators or, frankly, a footfault that get them in trouble with shareholders or other sort of actors, shareholders in the system.
Well, Professor Vogel, I'm afraid we only have 30 seconds left, but I'm going to give you the last word today.
Thank you. Let's talk in the last word about the people of Ukraine. Their freedom is absolutely crucial. If we want to really help them, we must give them not only military support, we must see that the sanctions are enforced really, fully, and effectively the way we can help the people of Ukraine who are suffering every minute is by seeing we have diplomatic enforcement of sanctions, justice enforcement of sanctions, and full economic enforcement of sanctions. Have those three things, and we help the Ukrainians.
Well, Frank Vogel, co-founder of Transparency International and now at Georgetown University, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure and honor.
And Adam Smith, former senior advisor at the Treasury Department and currently at the sanctions practice for Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. A great pleasure to have you as well, Adam. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.